First case, 21-1190, Van Sant and Company v. Town of Cowhand. Counsel?
Morning, Your Honors. My name is Tom McMahon. I represent the plaintiff appellant, Van Sant, here. Based on our separate expertise, I'll be splitting time with my colleague, Ben Wick. I will deal with the antitrust immunity issues. He will deal with the Section 1983 issues. We'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. This is the RV Park case. It arises out of events in the 2015 to 2019 time period in the tiny rural town of Cowhand out on the eastern Colorado plains. It involves a trailer park that was owned by Van Sant that in mid-2015, for economic reasons, began renting empty spaces long-term to recreational vehicles. That put it in competition with the two established RV parks in Cowhand. The larger one was 71% of the long-term rental spaces is Cadillac Jack's. It's owned and operated by Annette and Calvin Chaussee. The smaller one with 21% of the long-term rental spaces is Jolly's. Significantly, during the relevant time period, there were three Chaussee family members on the town government of Cowhand, two grandsons, Cameron and Tyler, and a son, Brent. Because of the family ties to Cadillac Jack's, they had personal and private interests in the RV park area.
Counsel, but when they acted in the way that you're contending was unauthorized, were they authorized to act? That is the position
we think that it was within their job description to act, but they were specifically prohibited by statute from voting or influencing others regarding the RV park ordinances because of their personal and private interests relating to Cadillac Jack's.
So you're arguing a conflict of interest as regards ethical concerns?
Yeah, well, it was a statutory violation, Your Honor.
What was the evidence of that before the district court?
Of the
statute? I'm aware of the statute, the Colorado statute,
right.
There
are two trusts, one the video trust and one the family trust. The video trust basically owns the assets of Cadillac Jack's, and these three individuals, Cameron and Tyler and Brent, were all beneficiaries of that trust and of the other trust. The other trust related to the property on which Cadillac Jack sits. So that's what the district court found in its opinion, that they were beneficiaries of the trust that basically controls Cadillac Jack's.
Okay. And so the district court's conclusion on that, how does that fit into your understanding of the law here?
Well, what the district court didn't do, and so let me turn to, in terms of this circuit's precedent, obviously the LGAA bars damages against local officials who are acting in an official capacity. And when you parse through the language and the opinions, basically official capacity is if you're acting within your job description. But what this court did in the GF Gaming case and what the Fourth Circuit did in the Sandcris case was look to the legislative history of the LGAA, and they both concluded that the intent of Congress was to limit the immunity to lawful actions. So on the one hand, you have a situation where nobody would argue that if you're in the town government, certainly you have a right to recommend and enact ordinances. But in this case, because of the factual circumstances of this case, all three of them were expressly prohibited by statute from recommending or voting on those ordinances, and that's where they ran afoul. And the district court even said in its opinion that it's apparent that some of these defendants in front of me engaged in some misconduct. And then having said that, He simply swept it under the rug and didn't account for that in terms of them violating something that there's a statute that they're specifically prevented from voting.
So, counsel, just as a practical matter, what was supposed to happen before the district court? I mean, you didn't come with a finding from Colorado State Court that there had been a violation of the statute. Was this supposed to be sort of a mini trial before the district court on the question of whether there was an ethical violation that then prevented them from voting?
Well, in this context, this was summary judgment. And so the question is, what is the evidence here? It's not who said what, it's what's the evidence. And the evidence is they had these personal and private interests. I mean, their family members, their immediate family members, they're beneficiaries of the trust. And the statute is clear on its face that they're not supposed to vote. And
What do you do with the burden of proof in the statute? What do you do about the burden of proof in the statute, that it requires proof beyond a reasonable doubt?
How do you pass that on to the
summary judgment standard?
That's only for a DA who is essentially prosecuting an ethical violation. That's not what we're doing here. We're not prosecuting that. We're not pursuing an ethical violation. We're using it to say that they don't have an immunity defense under the LGAA. That's a different thing. That's a typical preponderance of evidence in a civil matter.
And the LGAA immunity defense, whose burden is it to establish that?
Well, in this case, that's a good question. On Norr Pennington, it's clear that the burden is on whoever's claiming Norr Pennington immunity. I would say as the claimants under the LGAA.
Is it an affirmative defense?
Well, yes. Yes, it is. And then when we dispute that affirmative defense by saying that you acted unlawfully, then it's our burden to prove that they acted unlawfully.
But we still have to circle back to whether or not they were acting within their authority. And our case law tells us we are to read that broadly.
As I've said, normally they would be acting within their authority, except in this case, they're specifically prohibited by statute from doing that. And significantly, both in the GF Gaming case and in the Sandchrist case, the opinions both noted that there was no prohibition on doing what the claimants for immunity did. So they were found to have acted lawfully and within their official capacity because there was no statutory violation in GF Gaming and there was no bylaws prohibition in the Sandchrist case. So
the distinction that you're making is in GF Gaming, we observed that the plaintiffs didn't allege that the city officials lacked the authority. And here you're saying the exact opposite.
Yes, we're saying that they would normally have the authority except for this specific statutory prohibition that applies in this one particular circumstance.
So could you be specific when you're saying they, who exactly would be immune under the LGAA here? Would it be which individuals are we talking about?
Well, the three we're talking about are Cameron, Tyler, and Brent Chaussee. Cameron and Tyler were on the board, and Brent was on the Planning and Development Committee.
But Brent didn't vote.
Well, he voted in terms of the Planning and Development Committee to recommend this to the board. So, yes, he voted in that sense.
Is that something that we just accept as true? I mean, is that something that needs to be understood in terms of what the ethical statute requires?
Well, first of all, in terms of whether it's true or not, there's nothing in the minutes that itemizes from the Planning and Development Committee who voted which way. He was on the committee. He was there. They recommended. And I think it's a logical assumption because there's no record that he objected in any way, shape, or form. I think the other thing I should address, because time is growing short, is the Norr Pennington doctrine, which obviously immunizes petitioning government even to obtain anti-competitive ends. The problem here is that the defendants over and over and over categorically denied ever doing it, and it's their burden to establish their entitlement, and you can't establish your entitlement to it by denying that you tried to influence the government.
Did you make that argument before the district court?
Oh, yes, Your Honor. Yes, we did. Yes, we did. They claim we didn't, but yes, we did.
And it wasn't an alternative defense? How do you respond
to
that?
Well, you can plead alternative defenses, but when it comes to summary judgment, you've got to have some evidence to back up your entitlement to your claim of immunity. You can't just say it and sit back and do nothing. And what happened here, not only did they not do nothing, they categorically denied doing anything. And so the choice is, own up to what you did and say it. In all the Norr Pennington cases, that everybody admits they petitioned government in one way or another. And in this situation, they deny it. And the district court then made up a bunch of hypothetical assumed facts and as sort of straw men. And then,
well, I thought your argument was that, and the court considered the argument, that they were acting in a commercial capacity rather than a political capacity.
Well, yes, yes.
But now you seem to be saying the reverse.
Well, no, I'm saying to qualify for the immunity, you have to be acting in a political capacity.
Uh-huh.
What they did, in our view, there's all kinds of circumstantial evidence. They did everything behind the scenes. There's nothing in any of the minutes of anybody going in there to these board meetings and arguing against the arguing for, rather, these ordinances. If it was done, it was done behind the scenes. And there's all kinds of circumstantial evidence, including Calvin Chaussee telling an RV tenant of Van Zandt's, gee, I hope the board passes a ordinance that will restrict RVs exclusively to RV parks. Well, if he said that to somebody basically on the other side, what are the chances he didn't say that to his three family members who are in the town government? So with that, unless you have any more questions for me, I need to leave some time for my co-counsel. Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning. My name is Ben Wick. I'm here to discuss the constitutional issues that arose here. I think, the facts here are very relevant to that, and I think the context there is important because in 2015, when our client decided to start renting to RV spaces, Cadillac Jack's was the largest RV park in town, and it was owned by the Chauzies, whose grandkids were the mayor and a board member, voting on various ordinances that affected those RV parks. And they began passing ordinances in 2016, so not long after, requiring my client now to evict manufactured home tenants, get rid of all the manufactured homes on his property.
So you're basing your constitutional violation on a property interest?
That's correct.
Define that property interest.
Yeah, so there is a legitimate interest in being able to use and enjoy the property as it saw fit. There was no zoning here, and there was no steam
at all.
So
they could run sewer on the ground and hook up to water wherever they wanted to?
Well, they had to comply with regular building codes, but they had done that. There was no, it's not like, that might exist from the county or they didn't have that. That's not the argument here. The argument is that this was a legitimate, claim. Our argument is that they could operate any lawful purpose, including an RV park. And it's different from the Eason and Jordan Arapaho cases and the recent Brown case, where there were zoning schemes and the court said to have a protected
interest. So you're saying that your client had an inherent right to run this property as he saw fit?
I'm saying that
whether mobile homes or RV parks.
Well, yes, under the scheme in place, which wasn't one. There was no discretion by Callahan, which is the important key, to stop him from doing so. And their attorney confirmed that explicitly in an email, said there's absolutely no zoning regulations and that the town has no ability to stop
Were there any rulings by the town through any organization that would create a right in your client's property interest?
I see my time is up.
Go ahead, please.
There were no rulings that created a right to an RV park, but I think the key here is that there was none that prevented him from doing so, and because there was no zoning scheme, they didn't have any discretion like in those other cases to prevent him from doing so, which is really the key, there. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Marnie Nathan-Closter, and it's my honor to represent the town-related defendants, which is the town of Calhoun, and Brent, Cameron, and Tyler Shosey. And also at council table is Mr. Noosh, who represents the other defendants, who will be prepared at the end of this argument to answer any Nora Pennington questions you have as it relates to his clients. In reviewing this matter, I respectfully request the court focus on four issues or factors. First, what Van Sant actually argued in summary judgment and then preserved through argument in its opening brief. Anything not raised in those two matters and raised for the first time in its reply brief, either as a claim or an argument, should not be properly before this court under long-established precedent. Second, the plain language of both the LGAA Act as well as the plain language of the state statute relied upon by Van Sant, as that is what should guide an analysis of what those provisions
Counsel,
provide.
Counsel, I know you have 4 points, but on that one, what are we to do with the gaming case where it seems to be read alongside the statute to be adding some sort of a requirement?
And Your Honor, I think you have to read that full paragraph in the gaming case in context. And when you read it in context, the word lawful comes up in the context of official actions and defining what they're talking about. So the paragraph starts with plaintiffs don't allege that the city's lacked authority. And it ends with our position that an affirmative grant of explicit authority is not required for an employee or government official to be acting in an official capacity is consistent with the position taken by the Second Circuit. I think when you start with the plain language of the act, which talks about official action, and its goal, which is expressed in case law, as well as legislative intent and legislative history, that this is to be broadly applied. The point is, do they have the ability in their regular course of duties to do this?
So would you say if the record here clearly established a violation of the Colorado ethics statute, would Cameron, Tyler, Brent have been able to lawfully vote on the ordinance?
We don't have that factual basis
But it's a question that I think is really important to understand just sort of the practical dynamics of this case. So
in my mind, Your Honor, that is not what LGAA immunity is intended to address. It is intended to address federal antitrust claims. It is intended to provide broad immunity for everything that falls within the scope of a duty to be performed by an individual. And that is what we have here.
Even though it's completely unethical?
Antitrust and other sorts of ethics and other governing statutes throughout all of the states. And if LGAA immunity was to have an exception for any of those state statutes, even for conduct that any of us might find inappropriate or unfavorable or unsavory, then the act would have said that. The legislative history would have discussed that. But it is supposed to be broad wielding.
Well, that's so broad that they could just go out and set their mind to do everything wrong, and they'd be protected under your position.
Under the immunity from damages for a federal antitrust claim,
right.
Yes, but not under other state cases and claims. There could have been a declaratory relief claim brought in this case to declare the ordinance invalid, right? That would have been the appropriate way to handle a claim that the ordinance should not have passed the way it passed. But that is not what was brought. There is a DA procedure under the state ethics statute to address any purported wrongdoing. That did not occur here. There was no action taken by the DA. So I would respectfully say there are other remedies that is to be addressed in different forms of claims. But that's not the claim here. And the claim here is supposed to have broad wielding immunity.
Well, the claim here is that they were set up, that the town attorney said, no, there's no ordinances, do whatever you want. And then lo and behold, they came in and adopted these various ordinances that just cut the feet right out from underneath these people.
And I think that if you look at the full email from Mr. Parker and you actually read everything and not just the one sentence cited by opposing counsel in briefing, and you read the full email, it talks about there are a variety of other code provisions, right? Water and sewer are addressed in other code provisions because that is a clear health, safety, and welfare issue. There are other provisions you have to apply and comply with. You may not have to go through some sort of specific zoning classification process to convert to an RV park, but you still have to comply with these other regulations and be forewarned that there is on the horizon the potential for direct regulations governing RV parks. So keep your client apprised and pay attention. And within a month or so, right, exactly what the town attorney alluded to was in the process came forward. And in, during that time frame, and for months prior and 6 months after, the Van Sant property did not do anything that was RV park specific. And it's no different than the existing RV parks. If they choose to expand, which in some respects is what Van Sant wants to do, they want more stalls. They want RVs require different water and sewer hookups. Their property was not in compliant, as noted in the record, by the numerous code violations of things like water and sewer. So they were going to have to engage in work that would have taken them out of any grandfathering provision, even if they were covered under it, because they were expanding and changing the property in a material way.
Counsel, can you go back to my question?
Yes.
I'm still struggling with how would we write this in favor of your client on the LGAA claim? And specifically, how would we write it so that we would account for our precedent on interpreting the statute to require lawful action?
I think you start with the plain language of the statute. It is clear that it's official action. There is no exception for legality or lawful, right?
Okay.
In the statute. So you start with the plain language of the statute. You then move to the legislative intent, which is that it be broad in covering. You consider that there are other separate state law remedies for conduct that you may dislike or may not find to have been appropriate.
And so we ignore this case that we have, the gaming case.
No, I think when you look at the gaming case, it is talking about the scope of whether the conduct falls within duties. In that case, there was pretty distasteful conduct. Apparently, the grand jury found malfeasance or misfeasance, and still immunity applied. The same thing with Thatcher, by the way. You know, in Thatcher, the allegations were they had no jurisdiction to take the action they took, and that they violated their own oath of office statute by not complying with those procedures. They, too, still got immunity despite those allegations, because the focus is, does this fall within the type of conduct that the individuals at issue would be performing?
So does lawful mean permissible?
I think it means within the scope of their conduct, yes, not an illegal versus criminal conduct allegation. It is, does it fall within the type of regularly conducted activity of which even opposing counsel has acknowledged the enactment of this sort of ordinance does fall within that type of conduct that would regularly be occurring by board members.
So if your friends on the other side had come into summary judgment with a Colorado judgment against your clients, finding that they were in violation of the Colorado Ethics Code, you would contend in the summary judgment proceeding in this case that they're still entitled to LGAA?
Yes, I would, Your Honor, and I would say that there are other remedies, and that finding that they had would entitle those remedies, or they could have pursued a declaratory judgment to say that you acted without the appropriate procedures. They have other remedies, but we're talking about this narrow but important issue of LGAA immunity. And in the little time I have left, I'd just like to point out that when you focus on what was actually briefed, injunctive relief was never briefed in summary judgment or the opening brief. That claim and argument sailed when it was not preserved. Additionally, I would note, as Your Honors were talking about, there is no protected property interest that has been implicated here for due process. They simply had the right, like anyone else, to move forward and operate under appropriate regulations. That does not, under any of the case law, entitle them to ownership without unfettered restriction.
Would we have to reach that question here?
Well, to rule for you? You could certainly rely solely, like the district court did, on the rational basis review and the fact that for both the equal protection and due process claims, rational basis is all that's required. And these sorts of ordinance requirements are adopted across the state, as noted in the expert report and summary judgment briefing. And the state itself, through the Colorado Department of Public Health, has the same exact requirements. If that does not show health, safety, and welfare interest, I'm not sure what would. So I think you do not have to address the property interest. You can simply dispose of both 1983 claims under rational basis review. We've talked about, you know, considering only what's properly preserved and before you, that under the state ethics and the LGEA, the plain language governs, the legislative intent of the LGEA is important to keep in mind, as well as what the intent of the state statute is, right, which is to provide a DA procedure. There is nothing in the statute that talks about voiding any action as a result of such misconduct. It instead provides for certain money to be brought in through the DA and a process. And we've talked about the rational basis component very briefly and the fact that this is a legitimate ordinance with health, safety, and welfare purposes. And it's incumbent upon opposing counsel to negate under the case law every rational basis, legitimate purpose. And it's incumbent upon the court to make certain you have addressed whether
He argues that you come up with this health, safety, et cetera, rationale after the fact. This was just something that was dreamed up to justify your decisions.
And we would disagree. The entire purpose of the statute, right, is to address health, safety, and welfare, preventing sewers from opening on the property, preventing illegal water access. And there is no case law, and in fact, the case law I've read has indicated and that we cited in our brief, it doesn't have to use the words health, safety, and welfare.
What does your how does your motivation, the town's motivation, even factor into our rational basis analysis?
The case law is clear. Motivation is irrelevant. You are to look at the objective factors of the provision and the objective factors, as CDPHE has determined, right, for enforcing them themselves, is that these sorts of ordinances, water, sewer, and the like, are health, safety, and welfare. With that, Your Honor, we would respectfully request that you continue to uphold the summary judgment decision on the issues that are pending before you, and I'll give the last couple of minutes to my co-counsel.
Good morning. Eric Noosh on behalf of the non-governmental defendants. Because my time is short, I'll cut to the chase. The district court properly applied the Norr-Pennington doctrine, which clearly immunizes the allegations in this case. He applied the correct standard for summary judgment. He accepted the allegations that my clients were in a conspiracy with the town officials. There was nothing wrong with him doing that. And based on those allegations, which they get the benefit of, they rise and fall on those allegations. That conduct is clearly within the Norr-Pennington doctrine. The Norr-Pennington doctrine is a robust doctrine that exempts any type of conduct in the political process by private parties.
So what kind of actions could local officials take that would undermine Norr-Pennington immunity?
Well, according to the Supreme Court in the Omni decision in 1991, almost no actions. They asked, in Omni, the Supreme Court said, we are not going to carve out a conspiracy exception. The litigants in that case said, well, how about you carve out a bribery exception or something illegal under state or federal law? They said, we're not going to do that. This court, in the Cole v. First American Title case in 2011, expanded on that and said, bribery of a insurance superintendent is immunized. So to get to the point of my colleagues on the other side, they're saying, well, it has to be out in the open. They have to admit to a conspiracy. That is not consistent with either Omni or this court in Cole v. First American, because that you don't have to admit to bribery. You don't have to admit to a conspiracy to avail yourself to the immunity doctrine. There's just no authority for that. In fact, it's plainly inconsistent with Omni and this court in Cole v. First American.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Is there any time left? No. Okay. Thank you very much for your helpful arguments. The case is submitted.